All right, perfect. Thanks so much, Anne, for asking me to speak. I'm nervous because it's been, I think, a couple of months or so before I spoke anywhere. So, as I said before the meeting, I always get scared when I'm asked to speak over 10 minutes. So we'll see what happens. I would like to make sure I don't spend a lot of time on what it was like. So I'm going to try and watch the timer and stop what it was like at 5 minutes, because I really would like to talk about what I've learned about recovery in the years. First, some numbers out of the way. I have now been abstinent for just over 13 years, or excuse me, no, no, right, just over 13 years. I'm maintaining a 50-pound weight loss. And I came into this program the first time in 1992. I'm one of those people that has been a compulsive overeater since at least the age of seven, by my own actions and memory. I come from a family on both sides that have dealt with alcoholism. And I think in my own case, at the age of seven, I needed a drug right away, and alcohol, you know, didn't have a lot of access to alcohol, or I might be in a different program. I discovered sugar. I, over my lifetime, became a major sugar addict. I used to joke that I was probably the only adolescent, you know, child 8 or 9 years old that on Halloween would be trick or treating still at 10 o'clock at night. You know, I was just monstrous to acquire all that candy. It's such a hard and weird life to live when you're a compulsive overeater. You know, it involves a great deal of isolation. And most of my life, I have lived as an introvert, somebody who likes to be alone. And unfortunately, left to my own devices, I like to be alone with food and do very harmful things with food. And it's just been, you know, living in my disease, looking back today, is just such a sad and regrettable, you know, part of my life. I continued as a compulsive overeater. I think I got a little bit of a pause in my disease during the last few years of high school. I ran cross country, so I kind of became almost exercise bulimic. All that mileage every week helped me to continue my eating without showing it so bad. Then I went into the Navy, and then I rediscovered my disease. I got married to a woman when I was about 21 who turned out to be an alcoholic. And for a lot of years, we simultaneously continued in our own personal diseases, me eating, her drinking. And it just was a really unfortunate life. I first discovered program back around 1992. I was working with a woman who one day out of nowhere mentioned this problem she had with food. And I was like, well, what are you talking about? And she said, there's this program called Overeaters Anonymous. And at the time I was working a job as a computer operator, that the job went from like 4 until midnight every night. And the job only took about 2 hours of work. And so for about 6 hours, I was just alone with books and food. And, you know, it was a real, real, perfect place to work with this disease. And so when she said those words, I came in program and eventually got recovery. And eventually my wife divorced me because she wanted to keep on drinking. And so I was in this program for a good number of years. And I like to talk about the relapses because when I first got abstinent in program, I was very involved for about a year or two, and then I quit taking commitments, and I just started thinking at 2 years of abstinence, I could live that emeritus life where, you know, now I would just be an old timer showing up at meetings and so forth. And unfortunately, that caused me to just slowly drift away. And I drifted out of the program after about 5 or 6 years of abstinence. And then from around 1996 or seven until around 2010, I really wrestled to keep an abstinence. And one of the things, I left the program in around 2004 because I felt, as Chapter 5 comments, that I might very well be one of those people who's constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I like to mention that because what finally caused me to come into program was a confrontation with that sort of lying to myself that I'd been doing. And so with that, as I mentioned, I walked away from program in around 2006 and seven. And I'll pause just for a moment to say that I had a sister who was 10 years younger than me. And when I was a child, She came into my life at 10 years old. I was very excited. I had an older brother that, typical of older brothers, just mostly, you know, picked on me, made fun of me, you know, all those things that we do as siblings. And so I just adored the fact that I got this sister, and my mom loved to work. And so at 10 years old, I frankly became a surrogate parent to my sister. I was the one who had to get her up in the morning, get her changed and ready to take her to the sitters. Even when I later got a paper route, I was the family member who had to be home at 4:30 to pick her up from the sitters. I grew extremely close to my sister. And in 2010, I only share this just so that there's not a 6 degrees of separation or an urban myth. My sister one day on November 4th, 2010, was making a cell phone call and died in a head-on collision from distraction. It was perhaps the most devastating event in my life to this day. It just threw me in a real tizzy. I at first thought that I would quit using, you know, my food and any substances in a way to honor my sister. And I found myself day after day trying to renew that commitment. Every day I woke up and, you know, by noon or 1 o'clock, I was right back in the disease, planning the binge, thinking I'll just binge out this day. Tomorrow I'll get better. And this just went on and on for well over 300 days in a row. What finally knocked some sense into me was one day I had a nervous breakdown and started screaming at my neighbors in a way that made me feel like I was channeling my father, who was a rageaholic. That's a whole nother story. And I went into my house just absolutely shocked at who I had become. And I sat on my sofa, and I had the closest I could say to a sort of spiritual experience that's described with Bill and some of the early members of the Big Book. I was sitting there on the couch, and I thought of that line from the Shawshank Redemption, that I had a choice in the moment to either get started living or get started dying. And I was surely walking down the get started dying pathway. And so when that happened, I seriously got desperate in this program, and I came crawling back in the program. And to this day, I am so grateful. I was living in North Hollywood, and I went first to a 100-pounders meeting, and I was looking for this fellow to sponsor me, and he wasn't there, or he wasn't able to sponsor me at the meeting. But I heard a fellow say that, you know, if you're in this program and you have so much as one day's abstinence, you're a day ahead of the newcomer. And there isn't a reason in the world why you can't turn around and shake that newcomer's hand and welcome them to the program that you're hoping will save your own life too. And I really took that to heart. In fact, the whole first year I was in program, I used to go to meetings specifically 15 to 30 minutes early, just so I could help set up and stand at the door and shake the hands of everyone who came in. Because, you know, as you know, we were talking again at the meeting in Overeaters Anonymous, our meetings tend to be meetings where no one's standing at the front door to shake hands. We're all scared to death of talking to each other. You know, we want to come in once the meeting started. And I'm as guilty as anyone else. I tell you, after a meeting, as soon as no one's talking to me, I will disappear because I'm shy. My nature is to be shy, and I'll want to escape as soon as I'm awkward. In any way. And I had the good fortune on that Sunday meeting, I shared the most incoherent share I've ever shared in my life. And there were a couple of guys there that saved my life. After the meeting, they walked up to me and they said, "Look, we want you to go to this restaurant, sit at a table and wait for us. We're coming to save you." And sure enough, they did. They happened to be the two members, if you ever have heard of sober eating, they were the two sort of founding members of that concept in Overeaters Anonymous. And they proceeded to teach me that concept. And sober eating, they have a way of looking at food so that we can look at it in the same way that people with alcoholism look at alcohol. That once you can determine your alcoholic foods, then you don't eat those anymore. And the other thing you do, which is most important, is you share what you're eating with another fellow. You don't ever put anything in your mouth with having prior approval, and you stay honest about that. You know, my big problem, as I said, is I'm very bad at being honest with myself. And the thing I've learned in life is the real killer is lying to myself, because once I lie to myself, I can lie to you guys all day long. That's very, very easy. But lying to myself opens the door to all kinds of hell that this sort of disease creates. And so that was 13 years ago in November. And I have worked the program that way ever since. And as I mentioned, it's been a real lifesaver, you know. And the longer I've been in program, I've had a really good sponsor that has helped me to learn along the way. I think sometimes, you know, we come into the program, we want to get abstinence. We look at the steps as something we got to run, you know, we got to sort of go through. And then we hope our life will be okay. And people wiser than me, there's a fellow that will often say at a meeting that left to my own devices, all roads lead back to the food. And that's an unfortunate, simple fact that if I just drift away from this program, it's only a matter of time until the thought to have a little something extra or to have something naughty that I shouldn't eat, you know, will captivate me and drive me right back into the food. And so another thing that I just wanted to share that I feel has been so helpful for me in program is to understand that the point of the steps in this program is to transform us. And if we can understand that while we work the steps, we leave ourselves open to the sort of recovery that is really promised there in the Big Book. You know, the Big Book says if we're recovered, we will recoil from these foods we used to binge on as from a hot flame. And I'm happy to say that today, when I do what the program asks of me, which is send an email to my sponsor at night and tell him what I plan to eat and do the next day and how I felt the day I just finished this gone, that's important for my recovery. I always remind people, 13 years of recovery, I don't look forward to sending that email to my sponsor. It sucks. You know, it's 5 minutes that I could spend doing something else. But I know, and I ask myself every night one question, whether or not I want to be abstinent tomorrow. And the sad fact is, if I want to be abstinent tomorrow, I've got to do that footwork. The other thing I might like to talk about with the remaining time is what I've come to understand and learn in the transformative, the way the 12 steps are designed to transform us. And I would just like to share it because I think it's important for me to keep in mind. A lot of this conceptually, I'll just say right at the outset, is stolen from the concept of the Four Noble Truths. But I am grateful to know and see that over time, I've seen the 12 steps are trying to do four things to transform us as human beings. The first thing is to help us comprehend our disease. And if you take a look at the first three steps in the program, they're really all, well, let me say this. In order to comprehend our disease, we need those first three steps. You know, admitting I'm powerless over food is just an intellectual acknowledgement. I would also like to take a moment and say it's interesting. If you've ever heard of the Mandela effect, it's a psychological concept that has been named that over the past 10 years. And the Mandela effect refers to something that we believe is true when confronted with the evidence it actually is not. And I like to mention that because if you ask somebody on the street, what is the first step of the 12-step program? So many people will say it is, I'm powerless over food and my life has become unmanageable. And there's no and in the first step. There's a dash there. And in my experience, I have found the first step is a seesaw that I put myself on when I'm in the food. You know, I don't eat because my life is unmanageable. I make my life unmanageable until I have a reasonable excuse to eat. And that's how my disease functioned in my life. You know, everybody knows that amongst normal eaters, if you go through a seriously bad breakup, you're entitled to a pint of ice cream. That's the way normal people live. Now, I can take that as a serious event, but as a compulsive overeater, it eventually becomes I wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to be abstinent today. And then I drive to work and someone cuts me off on the freeway. And the next thing you know, I'm fantasizing about what I'm going to eat when I get home that night. Okay. So I'm in the absence of unmanageability, my disease wants to create it in my life so that I'll have a good reason to give in to my disease. And so I feel that. And step two, where we come to realize, to me, the essence of step two, higher power is extremely important. But for me, the essence of step two is to realize that no voice inside my head is ever going to help me. A lot of the voices inside my head are there to hurt me. Okay. And I hope that I have a higher power above to help me. But what I really need when I first come into program is to clearly understand that no logic in my head is going to get me through this program. And the third step asks me to make a decision to, while I'm working the steps and while I'm trying to become abstinent, I have to become willing not to give in to those voices and not to listen to them. And it's very hard in the beginning, especially when you first arrive at step three. That's a that's something that just causes more and more people to go right back out, is that they don't understand that I've got to become willing not to listen to myself for a while. So I mentioned that the 12 steps do four things. One, they help us comprehend our disease. Secondly, they help us to eliminate the causes of our disease. The third thing the steps do is they help us realize a spiritual experience for ourselves, hopefully for the first time, in a way that we can really see how it helps us remain abstinent with food. And then the fourth thing the 12 steps do is help us re-attain that spiritual experience. So as I just kind of briefly review the steps then, so having comprehended my disease in the first three steps, the next three steps, four, five, and six, are where I come to understand and abandon the causes. The whole point of taking an inventory is to look at those resentments that I've used as excuses to create unmanageability in my life so that I'll have a reason to, you know, order the food that I think will make me happy tonight. And when I work those steps sincerely and I understand that that inventory is an effort on my part to understand these, you know, causes that I use to overeat, it's very beneficial. Especially when I get to the third part of my recovery, which is how can I acquire a spiritual experience that will allow me to recoil from my foods as if from a hot flame. And a spiritual experience is a very, you know, ethereal thing. It comes and goes. If you've ever been, I grew up in the Midwest. I've been to Baptist revival meetings. They're amazing. You know, you'll come out of that just on a cloud. But in the absence of anything to help you reacquire it, that state of mind will fade. And any of you who have worked the steps of 7, 8, and 9 know that making amends is probably the scariest part of our recovery. That's one reason why I feel steps 7, 8, and 9 make us so ripe for a spiritual experience. And a better teacher than me is the one who taught me that when we read the ninth step promises, that's an inventory for a spiritual experience. A better teacher in me in these steps told me that he said, look, when we're at the end of step 9, if you can't read all those ninth step promises and say, yes, I feel this, I feel this, I feel this, then we need to go look at the steps and see what other work you have to do. And so that was just life changing for me. And the spiritual experience I acquired in step 9, again, as I mentioned, if I don't do work to sustain that experience or work with myself to learn how to reacquire that experience, I'm doomed. And that then is where the recovery steps, as I've been taught, steps 10, 11, and 12, quite simply, are three ways for me to reacquire that spiritual experience that has been such a godsend in my life. You know, step 10 asks me to take a daily inventory and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about promptly admitting I'm wrong. You know, it's a very scary thing. Makes me ripe for a spiritual experience when I become honest about myself and the life I'm living with others. Step 11, meditation. I could do a whole talk about meditation. It's changed my life. Meditation is weightlifting for the mind. There are things I can let go of today just because they're wrong for me to think of that I could never do before I learned how to meditate. I've got a minute left. And so I'll just say step 12, you know, when we reach out to others, for those of you that have helped other people in program, and I don't get that opportunity very often, but you know, too, how great you can feel about yourself when you help someone else with this disease. And so if that makes any sense, these three steps of 10, 11, and 12 are tools to help us reacquire that spiritual experience that I hope every one of you reach when you get to the end of step nine. I want to thank you so much for letting me speak and letting me at this meeting. And with that, I am done.